After 24 years on the air, Oprah Winfrey announced on Friday she would end her show, The Oprah Winfrey Show, in September of 2011.
After much prayer and months of careful thought, I've decided that next season, season 25, will be the last season of The Oprah Winfrey Show. These years with you, our viewers, have enriched my life beyond all measure.
There are few talk show hosts who've interviewed as many big-name actors, authors, and political dignitaries. Oprah's talked to them all. And this got us thinking about who might be chosen as the guest on Oprah's very last show. Never mind, it's almost 2 years away. For ideas, we've called Chicago Now blogger and WGN-TV reporter Marcus Leshock. On his blog, The Leshock Value, he lists some 20 or so contenders for this final guest chair. And he joins us now. Marcus, welcome.
Hello, Jennifer.
So in your blog, you take the attitude that it's never too early to speculate about something like this.
No, of course not, especially not on the internet. Yeah, I finally have stopped crying here in Chicago. So many people are so upset about this. We were just talking about this in our newsroom. Could any other person ever on television announce that they were going to retire in 2 years and it'd be like front page news? It's unbelievable.
So looking ahead then, give us some of your contenders. Who might be that big time last guest on Oprah?
Well, you know, I started the list just looking at people who have been on Oprah frequently. Somebody like Chris Rock, I believe, is the in the lead with 11 times being on her show. Others like Jim Carrey, Julia Roberts, people who might have been more popular about 10 years ago. But from the people who have been on there very frequently, one of my favorite guests is Will Smith. Anytime he's on the Oprah show, something wild happens. Doesn't matter if whatever he's promoting is garbage or anything like that. But whenever Will's on, it seems to be a very exciting show. He could be a fun last guest.
Well, I think we have a clip of one of his appearances there. Will Smith was a guest on the show in November of last year. Here's just after the election of President Obama.
The Chicago Sun-Times that just had the picture of him, and it had the only headline was Mr. President.
Wow.
I saw that. Just saying it now makes me a little...
Oprah, I'm not going to be... I'm an action hero. I can't be crying on your show.
I know. Did you cry?
I won't be crying at stuff, Oprah. But listen.
I was crying. I was...
Okay, so Will Smith can go on Oprah and cry there. Maybe he doesn't do that anywhere else. What's a number two pick?
A number two pick, of course, if we want to keep it on the celebrity front, Tom Cruise. How about ruining another couch on the Oprah Winfrey set?
She's probably got another one ready for him there.
I'm sure she like snaps her fingers and a couch just appears out of nowhere, Oprah Winfrey. But that appearance had to be one of the most bizarre and captivating appearances ever on television.
And this is, of course, when Tom Cruise declared his love for the lady who would become his wife, Katie Holmes. And let's relive a bit of the moment here.
We've never seen you behave this way before.
I know.
Have you ever felt this way before?
So maybe she'll get some more jumping around there. What about, let's go for a third. What's pick number three?
One for me, I would be very interested to hear from Mr. Stedman Graham. Are you familiar with who Stedman is?
I'm not.
Well, Stedman is Oprah's longtime boyfriend.
Uh-huh.
Who has lurked behind the scenes of this whole mess over the last 25 years or so. I'd love to see him get up there on the stage and tell us some tales. I'm sure he has plenty of things to talk about what it's like to date Oprah.
And see if she can get him to get as personal as some of the other folks.
There you go. And another one that's a personal favorite of mine, I would love this to happen, being a longtime Chicagoan, Roger Ebert, the film critic, of course, of Siskel and Ebert back in the day. About 25 years ago, Roger Ebert went on a date with Oprah Winfrey, and he convinced her to go into syndication. It's a very interesting connection to Chicago luminaries. To see him up on that stage, especially with all of the problems he's going through now with the cancer that he's fighting, it'd be very fitting, especially from a Chicagoan's point of view, to see those two up there and just talk about their life together. So many people don't know about that.
Kind of bringing it full circle then, if he helped her launch.
Yeah.
This last show is, am I correct, it's supposed to be in September of...
2011.
You
don't have it circled on your calendar yet? I was joking earlier, the Mayans were only 1 year off. The world will end in 2011 now because Oprah won't be on TV. There'll be no reason to live anymore.
Okay, well, it will still be a year before the next presidential election. But am I crazy to think that Oprah, who kind of broke precedent here by coming out and stumping for president, now President Obama, you think she's going to go for that big of a get?
Oh, I think for sure. And I think Obama would be foolish to turn her down. She did so much for him, campaigning for him back in the election there, that that was my pick for the obvious choice to have both Barack Obama and Michelle Obama come out on the show, and they can all raise their hands together and help him get to the White House again. Some other people were saying maybe Sarah Palin once again will make an appearance because she might be running for president then. I don't think Oprah will have her on in 2011 like she had the other day. So,
well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see. Marcus Leshock is a feature reporter at WGN-TV and a blogger at Chicago Now. His blog is called The Leshock Value, and he joined us from Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Jennifer Ludden, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
The HBO comedy series Curb Your Enthusiasm, created by and starring Larry David, presented its season finale last night, with an episode capping a year-long storyline about Larry finally agreeing to a reunion show of Seinfeld, which he created with Jerry Seinfeld. Our TV critic David Bianculli loved both programs, the show and the show within the show.
Only Larry David could have gotten away with what he just pulled off on Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's not just praise for his ability as a brilliant sitcom writer and improviser. It's also a plain fact. After Larry and Jerry Seinfeld ended Seinfeld when it was the top-rated sitcom on television, Larry, the behind-the-scenes co-creator, went out on his own. He created Curb, playing an exaggerated version of himself. Larry David, the guy who co-created Seinfeld, made skillions of dollars, but still found endless irritations in everyday life. He was the first of the Seinfeld gang to succeed in a new venture, and the premise set him up, years later, to attempt the unthinkable, to bring everyone back for a Seinfeld reunion show. He and Jerry would never think of doing it for NBC, their old bosses, for real. That would be too ordinary. But to do it for HBO, as part of a complicated plot that has the TV Larry agreeing to do an NBC reunion special only so he can get back together with his estranged wife, that's not only different, it's perverse. With the old Seinfeld sets pulled out of storage and the old cast members reunited, this entire season of Curb has been a flirtation with its alternate reality. And like some not-quite-real bizarro world, a Superman reference the real Jerry Seinfeld no doubt would appreciate, the whole thing came to a head this weekend when HBO bought ad time to promote, during NBC's Saturday Night Live, the Curb season finale.
We already screwed up one finale. We can't do another.
We didn't screw up a finale. That was a good finale.
The season finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm, only on HBO.
Think of how much salt HBO was rubbing in NBC's wounds with that ad. 11 years ago, Seinfeld was the hugest thing on TV, and NBC had it. But in 2009, the Seinfeld cast reunited on cable TV instead, while NBC's Peacock has so little plumage left, it's in danger of being killed and served at Thanksgiving. But the amazing thing about this Curb-Seinfeld combo platter is how beautifully everyone delivered. Jerry and Larry worked together brilliantly, and you can actually sense the chemistry that made them such a creative team. Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's doing her own stellar sitcom work on The New Adventures of Old Christine on CBS, was a riot as an older but still not wiser Elaine. Michael Richards, banished to showbiz limbo after his racist rant 3 years ago, allowed himself to be the butt of jokes on that very topic. And Jason Alexander, as Larry David's alter ego, George Costanza, had an obvious ball portraying himself as someone who didn't like Larry all that much, and certainly didn't care for the original Seinfeld finale. Slowly, over several episodes, the Curb version of the Seinfeld reunion began to take shape. Larry had to overcome several obstacles, but finally succeeded in casting his estranged wife Cheryl, played so endearingly by Cheryl Hines, in the show. That's the clever plot of Curb. But the plot of Seinfeld, the reunion show itself, was just as good. When we got to see all the actors at what's called the table read, the first pass at reading aloud a new script, what I was knocked out by was how well written it was. The reunion show plot, filling in the lives of the characters over the intervening years, had George marrying Amanda, the character to be played by Cheryl, becoming a mega millionaire after developing a particularly useful iPhone application, then divorcing Amanda and losing his money to Bernie Madoff. The table read, with Jason Alexander as George and Cheryl Hines as Amanda, made it clear. This would have made a terrific episode of Seinfeld. For real.
Scene H. It's in the coffee shop. This is day 4. George, Amanda.
I've been dreading having to tell you about the whole Madoff thing.
Oh, well.
You must hate me for losing our money like that. We're wiped out.
Actually, I'm fine, George.
Fine?
Yeah, I took my half out of Madoff right after we got divorced.
You what?
Yeah, I still have my half.
Why did you take it out?
I bumped into Madoff on the street one day, and he was wearing this quilted jacket with the collar up, and for some reason, it creeped me out. So the next day, I pulled all my money out. Turns out I did quite well by him.
Collar up? Creeped you out? That's my money! You have my money!
Not according to the laws of the state of New York.
And then, last night, came the capper. I thought Larry David had reached his career peak with the season-long producer's storyline of Curb, but last night's show was even better. It actually gave us, in miniature, another episode of Seinfeld. But it also gave us happy endings and unhappy ones when we didn't expect them. And also served up the delicious plot twist that had Cheryl becoming attracted to Jason. That meant Larry was competing with and losing to the guy who played Larry's doppelganger on Seinfeld. And he was losing her precisely because he cast her in the show. That's when, on this Curb season finale, Larry flips, Jason walks out, and to save the reunion show and his chances with Cheryl, Larry offers up a desperate solution, which the other cast members reject immediately, Jerry Seinfeld especially.
Okay, so how do we do the show without Jason?
It's just material. It's just a script, lad. There's no show without Jason. How do you even have the show? What do you have? Yeah, you have a three-legged goat here.
So what are we doing?
I don't know. We're not doing anything.
Larry, what do you want to do?
I'll play George.
What?
I'll play George.
What? Yeah.
Yes! I can do it!
We'll play what, George's butler? What do you mean?
No, I will play George Costanza. I can do it! I know I can. Right. I wrote it. The character's based on me. There were two Darrens.
Yeah.
On Bewitched.
Nobody liked that second Darren. I didn't care for the second Darren.
But you bought it.
Oh, my.
Do you understand what this is? This iconic television here. That's an icon. He's an icon. She's an icon. He was an icon. Icon. No con. There's no John, Paul, George, and Larry. It's not what they want.
Actually, by this point, they're all icons, even Larry. Curb Your Enthusiasm is the best TV comedy of the year, and last night's finale didn't let me down. It lifted me up. And the fact that the Seinfeld reunion took place on cable, not broadcast TV, well, that's a perfect analogy for quality TV as it exists today. More and more, cable TV is where it's at. Broadcast TV is where it was.
David Bianculli writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film at Rowan University.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The sensitive New Age guy has finally arrived in Japan. He's kind, he's gentle, and he's thrown off the traditional macho image of the Japanese male. There is one important catch. The new Japanese man does not appear to be interested in women, which is a problem in a country with a declining birth rate. NPR's Louisa Lim investigated on a recent trip to Tokyo.
In Tokyo at weekends, the trendy area of Harajuku is a sort of melting pot of urban tribes. Here, the Lolita goths batter their fake eyelashes while the punks glower. Away from the strutting are the retiring wallflowers, a quiet army of sweet young men with floppy hair and skinny jeans. These young men are becoming known as Japan's herbivores, girly guys who are heterosexual but aren't really interested in matters of the flesh. Yukihiro Yoshida is an economics student and a self-confessed herbivore.
I don't take initiative with women. I don't go and talk to them. I'd welcome it if a girl talked to me, but I'd never take that first step myself.
Nowadays, surveys show that about 60% of young Japanese men identify themselves as herbivores. Their Sex and the City is a television show called Otomen, or Girly Guys. The lead character is a martial arts expert, but his secret passions include sewing, baking, and crocheting clothes for his soft toys. I will hide my true nature, he says as he sews. At all times, he vows, I will be a man, a real Japanese man. But what does that mean nowadays?
It's not so much that men are becoming more like women, it's that the concept of masculinity is changing.
Katsuhiko Kokobun should know. He owns Guzzle, a popular hair salon in Harajuku. Over the years, he's seen more and more men come into his salon, and they're demanding more traditionally female treatments.
We have eyebrow plucking and facials for men, and the eyebrow plucking is very popular among high school boys.
Oh, hello. Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Louisa.
The changing tastes of Japanese men is quite literally what takes up Yasuhito Sekine's days. He works for a website, and he's the founding member of an online group called Sweets Club, especially for men who like puddings. Set up in January, it already has 1,000 members who get together to debate the virtues of different brands of strawberry shortcake. It's something which he believes would have been unthinkable 20 years ago.
Back then, lots of men liked desserts, but it was considered uncool. Cool men had to like alcohol or spicy food. I've discovered my father likes eating dessert, but he never showed it in the past.
Putting Sekine through his paces with an impromptu taste test, he praises peach jelly as fresh tasting. He's not so keen on coffee jelly with cream, a macho pudding if ever there was one, labeling it retro. He believes his pudding club shows how young Japanese men are asserting their individuality, reflecting a change in values from Japan's booming 80s.
Back then, Japanese men had to be passionate and aggressive. But now those characteristics are disliked. Our members have very mild personalities. They simply enjoy what they like without prejudice.
Japan's top expert on herbivores, a columnist who christened this tribe, believes they were born out of the lost decade of economic stagnation. Maki Fukusawa argues the herbivores are rebelling against the salaryman generation of their fathers. They've turned away from the macho mores and conspicuous consumption of that era.
They have some feelings of revulsion towards the older generation. They don't want to have the same lives. And the impact of the herbivores on the economy is very big. They're such big news now because sales are down, especially of status products like cars and alcohol.
But there are fears about the financial and social impact of herbivores. Their low levels of spending and lack of interest in sex invoke two of Japan's biggest problems, its lackluster economy and declining birth rate. Herbivores do like to be friends with women, but that's as far as it goes. Back in the streets of Harajuku, Alex Fujita explains why it never goes any further.
Nowadays, women have more education and enjoy working. Women are scary now.
And of course, there's a name too for the economically empowered working Japanese women who know what they want. The carnivore women. With herbivore boys and carnivore girls, it seems the land of samurai, sumo wrestlers and geisha girls is remaking its gender landscape anew. Louisa Lim, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. There is a new princess in town, at least in a few select cities this week. Disney is introducing its latest heroine, Tiana, in the animated feature The Princess and the Frog. In a few weeks, she'll be in theaters around the country.
The movie is set in 1920s New Orleans, where a visiting prince gets turned into a frog. He's well-versed in the fairy tale cure for his condition, so he shows up at a Mardi Gras ball, hoping that a kiss from a princess will make him human again. The strong-willed young lady is also Disney's first African-American princess. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports that a lot of black parents and their children are greeting Tiana with high hopes and open wallets.
They've been waiting at the Westfield Culver City Mall for hours now. Mothers and daughters and even some dads, all eager for the double glass doors of the new Disney store to officially open. Denise Ross and her daughter Alana waited 3 hours for the store to open.
I'm just excited. I'm even having my own Tiana Princess party. Yes, we are.
And we're going to go see the movie.
And I'm taking a group of kids to the movie to see the movie after the party.
In fact, Tiana fever is much more apparent among black parents, especially mothers, than their daughters. There's a deep emotional satisfaction in finally having someone who looks like them as a lead Disney character. Ron Edwards came with his 4-year-old, Morgan. He thinks it's important to buy Tiana merchandise to send a message to the Disney company.
Especially because it's one of the first characters, you know, African-American characters that Disney has really given a whole, you know, marketing campaign to. So it's good for little girls such as mine to see themselves in, you know, a positive light.
Sidra McLaurin agrees but has one reservation.
I'm disappointed that the prince is not African-American.
The interracial romance between Tiana and Prince Naveen has been controversial. Many black women worried aloud, on the internet and in the press, that pairing Tiana with a non-black prince sends a discouraging message about the possibility of black couples finding their own happily ever after. But that concern aside, black consumers have invested in Tiana with a joyful ferocity that's making cash registers ring like crazy.
We're selling out of individual items, particularly the dolls and the role play. The dresses are doing incredibly well. And this is before the movie's even come out. People are loving this product before the movie comes out.
At Disney's corporate headquarters in Burbank, Mary Beach, vice president of franchise development, is giving a tour of the Tiana-palooza of merchandise that's being released.
We have symbols, the Ray maraca here, which I love.
Ray is a lightning bug, the movie's Cajun Jiminy Cricket. Bath products were contracted out to a black beauty company, Carol's Daughter.
Sometimes the beauty products come later. They want to wait to DVD or wait till another time to make sure the film hits.
Beach says this company wanted in right away. Disney hasn't always felt such love from black consumers. Many baby boomers remember their parents' angst at movies such as Song of the South. Then there were the crows in Dumbo.
But I'll be done seeing about everything when I see an elephant fly.
What you say, boy?
I said when I see an elephant fly.
Those lazy, no-count crows made black parents cringe. This is different. Back at the mall, even Disney staff are amazed at the turnout, which stretches the length of the complex. Awestruck children of many ethnicities are lined up to be greeted by Disney's newest princess and have their pictures taken.
Now come on over so I can get some big old hugs. Oh, thank you so much, sugars.
Disney store manager Barbara Williams gets a little emotional when she talks about it. Williams is proud of the Tiana launch as a Disney employee and as a black consumer. She says at the close of a black cultural festival recently, a man came by just as the festival was ending.
And he saw the Disney booth, and he turned and he said, "Tell Disney they did good."
With Tiana, Disney is banking goodwill and its more tangible byproduct. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
There's magic in the air tonight.
And anything can happen.
I suppose you want a kiss.